RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everyone. Chris Landry here for the Tuesday, October 3rd edition of the Landry Football Podcast, where we talk all things football, college and NFL. And we're going to get to some of the game actions and what happened this past weekend, giving you a film room look at what happened on the field, college and the NFL. But I want to spend a good bit of time kind of going through what I like to call the rise and fall of LSU football from the inside. And as many of you know, in my work, doing consulting work for NFL teams and college programs that involve scouting and coaching consulting, it also involves a lot of coaching search work. And we're going to provide you some insight because it is very topical with the devastating loss by LSU against Troy as to how we got here with LSU football and kind of the rise under Nick Saban, how the program was built in the modern era. And as someone who coached at LSU and as someone who was intimately involved in a lot of the processes in consulting and advising in some of the decisions that have made inside that have kind of really exposed really ineffective athletic directorship through the whole process. So we're going to get into that. And I want to really start with that as to kind of how the program, when I was coaching at LSU and under Bill Arnsberger and Mike Archer. And, you know, I saw the program at that point with the athletic director, Joe Dean, who was hired to essentially be the anti-Bob Broadhead. The program was in the red. We needed to get that program back with the very, very foolish spending of Bob Broadhead. Joe Dean was hired to be a money manager. And Joe Dean, to tell you, he was the best money manager around, and he was very good at it. And having worked for Joe Dean, when you know he definitely was that. Everything was about trying to save a dollar. He wasn't great at visualizing how to go out and make money, but he was very good at saving it. And that's where the program was. The facilities were not very good. They were right at the bottom of the league in the SEC. And the process of hiring coaches were very poor. And I'm going to go back, you know, when I left LSU and took a job in the NFL with the Cleveland Browns. I joined Bill Belichick's staff, and on that staff was a guy by the name of Nick Saban, who I work with, got very close with. And as we're through the process of, you know, doing our job in Cleveland, in my work, some in-house doing coaching and quality control work as well as on-the-road scouting, you know, I kept very close ties on obviously everything that's going on around college football at the time and certainly near and dear to my heart, LSU, which is where I graduated, by the way, and went to school and graduated and got my first coaching job at the college level. And the process of them going about, and I was there when Joe Dean hired Curley Hallman. He was hired on the cheap because they could get him cheaply, and he was hired because he had some success against Alabama, Auburn, Florida State, pulled some upset with Brett Favre as his quarterback. Curley was not, you know, was a disaster hire, and it was early from the first week there that I realized that he was going to be in over his head. But then we go to that disaster, which is probably the worst era in terms of trying to look at LSU football in the modern history. And then the process went, and people may forget this, but LSU actually decided to hire Pat Sullivan, the head coach at TCU at the time. And to give you an idea of how the social media and environment has changed, can you imagine that happening today, where they literally call a press conference to announce the hiring of a new head coach, only to have to cancel it because they both were in disagreement and who was going to pay the $750,000, not $7 million, but $750,000 buyout that was owed to TCU. Well, Joe thought Pat was going to handle it, Pat Sullivan. Pat Sullivan thought LSU was going to handle it. Well, they disagreed on that, and so they just canceled the conference. No, we're not going to hire you then. Then quickly, the board member, infamous board member, Charlie Cusumano, hired a guy that he knew, happened to be at Vanderbilt. They just got off a 70-point drubbing by Tennessee. And they just go ahead and hire Jerry DiNardo. DiNardo's hired, did some good things, but obviously very inconsistent and really, I thought, calmed the program a little bit, but certainly never grew anything. And it was in an environment where it was very tough to grow. But during that process, when they were considering Pat Sullivan and then eventually settling on Jerry DiNardo, I had recommended to Joe Dean, and Richard Gill, the late Richard Gill, who was the big money booster there, that they really take a look at Nick Saban, a guy that I had really developed confidence with. Nick was a fast-rising young coach, had been successful in a brief tenure at Toledo, and was already getting head coaching inquiries from the NFL. But knowing Nick, knowing his passion for college football, I knew that it would be a really good fit, in my view anyway. Ohio State, which had John Cooper at the time, had some interest. If you might remember, John Cooper was on the hot seat every year, and one of the names that was prominently mentioned was Nick Saban. We all know Nick ended up taking the Michigan State job. But before he did, I had recommended highly that they take a look at Nick Saban. Nick wasn't going to come cheap, but they could have gotten him for less than the $1.2 million that they ended up having to pay him in the next go-around in the coaching hire. But again, different time, different circumstances. One of the issues that Nick always had about LSU, and he always questioned me about, if it's such a great job, Chris, is what I always heard, then why is everybody getting fired over there? And it's having to, quite frankly, go through the process of poor administration, board of supervisor interference, poor athletic directorship, poor growth, lack of money into the program. Louisiana's not a rich state, and LSU's not a rich school, and it doesn't have the sugar daddies that, the Alabamas, the Auburns, the Tennessees, a lot of the programs have. LSU does not have. They have to raise the money, by thousands, and can't get million-dollar checks as readily as others can. And so you have an issue where they weren't able to attract the right coaches, and quite frankly, those coaches were not given the proper type of support to be successful. The facilities were awful. Even the recruiting budgets were near the bottom in the conference, something that was not sufficient to compete at a high level. So one of the issues and concerns was, well, how do we correct that? And one of the things that I spent countless hours talking with Nick about was what needed to be done at LSU, that they needed a new football facility, that they needed a new dorm room, living facilities. They needed a new place, an academic center, all things that he eventually put in his proposal to LSU. But the problem was, when LSU was first looking and not interested, when I brought up Nick Saban, it never got anywhere because, A, Joe wasn't really looking to spend money, and, he was looking to go on the cheap. DiNardo came cheap, relatively cheap at that time. And, they weren't really committed quite to the level that they needed to be. They were committed with the resources that they had, but they didn't have the type of vision and leadership. And I love Joe. He's a basketball guy. He didn't have the right context. He used his good buddy was Gil Brandt, who is more of a fast talker, self promoter, and really doesn't know football like a lot of people think he does. And it got that got him Curly Hallman, quite frankly. And that didn't work. So Joe was kind of out there, and at that point, there was not a great deal of interest by Nick in LSU, and that really didn't sit well with Joe and the rest of them, so that never took place. So obviously, DeNardo gets hired at LSU, and again, does some good things. Then off goes Nick Saban. Nick Saban's at Michigan State, does good things there. As he's developing and growing there, there's certainly interest. The Colts were interested. The Giants were interested. There were a number of teams that were interested in him making a move to the NFL. While that was a consideration and was always something that I thought was going to be potentially there for him, a move to a bigger college was something that was always on the books. Now, I can tell you that Nick liked it at Michigan State, and that had it not been for the president at Michigan State going back on some of the promises that he made to Nick for his program, he would have stayed there. The facilities and things that were on the board getting done just never got done. They basically were empty promises. So when the opportunity started to come about, he started to listen to more and more of them. Well, as the tenure of Jerry DiNardo is being made, and this is being done by the new chancellor at LSU, Mark Emmert, now the NCAA president. Mark Emmert had a vision, and it was the best thing that ever happened to LSU because he created a vision for the athletic department, for the football program, of growth. Let's spend money to make money, and let's grow this. Let's do this right. He did it through the entire LSU community, academic and otherwise. But he goes through the process, and at that point, and they're looking at different ideas and candidates, and he's using Joe to do a lot of groundwork and legwork. Well, at this point, Nick Saban has got a lot of interest from a lot of people, and I then again constitute the conversation with Nick about LSU and the possibilities. At that point, quite frankly, there's not a lot of interest. A lot of questions about the administration, the leadership. I'm hearing good things about Mark Emmert, but I don't know Mark Emmert. So through the process, getting to know people, knowing Richard Gill, knowing Joe Dean, knowing some other folks, I'm hearing good things about Mark Emmert. I get to meet Mark Emmert, and there's only so much you can ascertain through a couple of conversations, but you get a lot of good vibes that he is willing to do things and put things together. So, listen, I go back to Nick and I say, I don't know this guy from Adam, but he seems like he's really committed to doing things the right way. Why don't you consider putting it together with Jimmy, his agent, Jimmy Sexton, a proposal of all the things that you want, that you need to get this program in the right direction. And Mark Emmert's idea was, look, if we get things better, then we're going to make it a more attractive job. Why is it that we can't attract the top job, top coaches, if it's traditionally one of the better jobs? And it was, but it didn't have the resources, and they didn't put their money where their mouth was. And one of the real keys that we talked about with Nick is, hey, look, this is a great state for recruiting. It's the only school in state, and Nick had been at Michigan State, where it's second fiddle to Michigan any way you look at it. And you got a much better state in terms of high school football talent, Louisiana, and you've got no competition in state. It is the school. You can put a fence around the state, and there's more players in the NFL per capita from Louisiana than any place. So then it becomes really attractive with them. But is it a fit personality-wise? Well, still don't know how that's going to work out and whether there's much of an interest or not. So one of the things, and you got to remember, Nick sees me as somebody that is very pro-LSU. So I'm thinking I've got to get somebody else involved that maybe can be more objective, that he will respect from an objective viewpoint that LSU is a great job. So I made a phone call to Bill Arnsberger, who, as I mentioned, I work for at LSU. who obviously gave him a firsthand account of what it was like to be the head coach. And I still say to this day that if it's not for Bill Arnsparger, I don't think Nick Saban comes to LSU. It was that conversation which was so stellar, it really opened up Saban's eyes. Bill talked about how great it was to work with Richard Gill, who was the chief booster and helping to get things done, and how his time there was great, the fans were great, all those things were great. And it created, I think, a level of excitement in Nick to the point where I think there was legitimate interest. It was at that point, and only at that point, that Nick instructed Jimmy Sexton to try to, you know, get in on the job and show that there was interest. Now with Mark Emmert, there's no real connection to Mark Emmert with Jimmy Sexton, myself, or anyone. So it's to try to make that connection to see where it goes. Well, Jimmy Sexton has a friend in Memphis. Jimmy's from Memphis, was an equipment manager at University of Tennessee, has befriended Reggie White, and became a successful agent, player agent, now the best coaching agent out there. Jimmy has a good friend in Memphis by the name of Sean Toohey. Sean Toohey, if you remember the Blind Side movie, Sean Toohey was the man, you know, the man and the dad and the family that adopted Michael Orr. But Sean Toohey was a basketball player at Ole Miss. Joe Dean's a basketball guy, did basketball games from television, was a Converse administrator for years. So he knew the basketball guys very well. He knew Sean Toohey. So there goes the connection to say, hey, look, Joe, you really, you know, I think that Nick Saban would be interested now. You know, why don't you check into it? So the channels go up through Mark Emmert, who's essentially running the search and is going to make the decision. Then there becomes the conversation, and then the rest is history. Nick puts his plan together. Mark Emmert puts it together. An interesting side note is, as they're negotiating, Jimmy Sexton basically lets it out that it's going to cost between $800 and $1.2 to get it done per year. And I never forget Joe Dean, and this was relayed to me by Mark Emmert, that Joe said, called Mark Emmert when they finally looked like they were going to get a deal done with Nick, that, hey, I think I can get him for $925. And that was, Joe was always with the mantra of, how can I get a guy for the cheapest price? And it was at that point Mark Emmert said, Joe, pay him the high mark, $1.2 million. If we're going to be serious about this, we're going to be committed to him, and we want to show commitment to him. We're not going to start out in the gate by going on the low end of that. That's ridiculous. So ended up, if you remember, it was $1.2 million. He was the highest paid coach in the country, and it seems pale now, but that was big news in 2000. Nick Saban goes to build an LSU program, builds it into a national championship program. His departure. People ask me a lot because there was a lot of involvement by me in some of how that played out. Obviously, my connections in the NFL, Eddie Jones, an LSU guy who was the president of the Dolphins for Wayne Huizenga at the time, courted Nick Saban. There were other teams that were interested. Nick kind of passed it down. Nick wanted a situation where he could have complete control of personnel, but Nick was really happy at LSU. And people say, you know, and he's often said he shouldn't have left. Well, the reality is Nick was going to leave LSU once Mark Emmert left. Once Mark Emmert left to go to Washington, Nick's days were numbers. The LSU people didn't know it, but that was the reality. Nick did not bother dealing with Joe Dean or Skip Bertman, who replaced Joe Dean as athletic director. Nick dealt with Mark Emmert, and Mark Emmert had a right-handed guy, Scott Woodard, who's now the athletic director at A&M. They basically, it was an open line to Mark Emmert. it was the chancellor, you know, head coach had answered right to him. And the athletic director was there just to facilitate what the head coach wanted. That's how it worked. Once Mark Emmert left, it just wasn't the same. He had to deal with Skip Ertman, who's a little quirky and goofy. It just was not going to be, you know, as good. So at that point, he wasn't looking to jump ship, but the next best opportunity, he was leaving. The Miami situation became a really good one for him. He decided to go, and I can still remember, you know, that Thanksgiving holiday, a Christmas holiday where he was deciding and back and forth, and he was having a hard time of it. And I do believe that if Mark Emmert were still there, he would have passed over the Dolphins' opportunity. I think Mark Emmert would have put together a package, probably make him the athletic director, probably had somebody be the athletic director under him to do all the work, but give Nick the power. I think there has been a lot of things that would have been maybe even associate chancellor's title. I think it would have been something that he could have probably kept Nick. We'll never know because he wasn't there, and that was the, as Nick said to this day, the best boss he's ever had. So Nick goes off to Miami, and so LSU now is in the market for a head coach, and now they're Skip and working with Skip and the guys in that athletic department. There were a number of guys that they looked at. But again, you're dealing with a baseball guy who has contacts, but it's tough when you don't know football, and most athletic directors don't. They're looking at different people, and Les Miles is intriguing to them, and not a bad hire by any stretch, but there were other better options out there, but there was not a lot of patience and not a lot of know-how in getting that done. So, for example, they got word that Jack Del Rio was interested in the job. Jack Del Rio was the head coach of Jacksonville Jaguars. I informed Skip and his staff Jack was not interested in coming here, that he was simply using LSU to get more leverage in his situation in Jacksonville. Well, the comment, well, no, he's interested. He's telling us he's interested. And I'm like, guys, the whole point is to create an interest. It has to be believable. Sure, they're telling you he's interested, but he's just trying to create leverage in Jacksonville. Word gets out. Wayne Weaver, the head, the owner at Jacksonville, kind of calls Jack in. Skip and their lieutenants, Virg Osbury and people, show up at the airport to meet Jack Del Rio, and Jack doesn't show up. This was the same weekend that Nick Saban was getting ready to coach his last bowl game against Iowa. Jack Del Rio doesn't show up. So they find out what I'd been telling him, that he wasn't interested, he was just using him. And at that point, after going through the process, Skip Ertman got frustrated and said, you know what, to hell with it. I'm going to just go and hire Les Miles. I'm tired of dealing with this. So they hired Les Miles. I think we all know Les Miles did a good job at LSU. Say what you want. Yes, it was largely Nick Saban's constructed team that won the national title that Les, was a part of. But he was the head coach, and he was able to get the ship going in the right direction, even though it was basically put in place for him. But as time wore on, you could see, as Les got more and more into the program, you saw less than ideal circumstances of how to build a program and how to sustain a program. It did include another run at a national title in which they got beat soundly by Nick Saban, who at this point had moved on from Miami to Alabama. And at that point, you know, there becomes some issues and there's come some frustration. Now, in between those two times, there was a quote-unquote interest by Michigan in Les Miles. Miles, I can tell you, as part of the searching committee at Michigan, that Bill Martin and Mary Sue Coleman had absolutely no interest in Les Miles. This was the first time when the whole announcement by Kurt Herbstreit that Les has been offered the job at Michigan. Nothing further from the truth. That was a leak put out by Michigan. to kind of throw everyone off course because Michigan was not interested. Now, there were people in the booster faction that wanted Les Miles, former players and whatnot. But I can tell you that Lloyd Carr, who was very involved when he left, very close relationship with the president, Mary Sue Coleman, Lloyd Carr hated Les Miles and vice versa due to some underhanded things that Les Miles did when Lloyd got the job, including using and recruiting against Lloyd that Lloyd had Parkinson's. Some things really got bad blood there. Les was never going to get the job. Les and his agent, George Bass, was trying to get Michigan on the phone all week of the conference championship game against Georgia, and they couldn't get him. Michigan, Bill Martin would not return the call. Yet on that Saturday morning of the conference championship game, it leaks out that Les is going to be the next head coach at Michigan. Well, Les knew that it was false because he and his agent couldn't get in touch with Michigan. So they knew they had been kind of played in that Michigan was throwing it out to throw it off course and then go and hire whoever they wanted to hire. And at that time, it was an ill-fated decision to hire Rich Rodriguez, but that's what they did. That's who they wanted, not Les Miles. That led to the frustrating press conference by Les Miles the day of the SEC championship game against Georgia. So then it plays out, and of course we go the next time around where the Michigan job comes open again. There again, quote-unquote, Michigan's interested in Les Miles. The new the president, still the same, new athletic director, not interested in Les Miles. But due to pressure from their booster faction, which was largely made up of former players who wanted Les Miles, they met with Les. They met with him in Baton Rouge at the famous Voodoo Barbecue setting and near Les's homes, home on Jefferson in Baton Jefferson Highway in Baton Rouge. They don't make him an offer, but again, the leverage that Les uses basically gets Joe Oliva to give Les a huge increase in salary and huge buyout money. Again, this was kind of the first step of Joe Oliva being in position. Skip Bertman was duped the first time by Les Miles, but it was the second Michigan flirtation that was the first time that Joe Oliva got played by George Bass, the agent for Les Miles, into getting him a super deal that locked him in and locked his assistants in and basically put LSU on the hook for a ton of money. Well, as time really grew and developed, Joe Oliva did not like Les Miles, didn't trust Les Miles. I think he figured out he had been used, so I thought that became a personal issue. But then also there were reasons on the field that grew frustrating, understanding that they weren't doing anything offensively to improve, that they were really good and had everything in place, but they were wasting some good time with the success of the program by underachieving from a coaching standpoint. So as time approaches and time develops, their issues and frustrations, but they're in essence kind of stuck with Les for a while. It gets to the point into 2015 where Joe Oliva leaks to the press, to a sports writer in town in Baton Rouge, that how well LSU performs the rest of the season is going to determine Les Miles' job fate. That basically Les Miles, his job is up in the air. It was how it was written. And trust me, the writer who is not going to take that information and go with it unless he gets confirmation by the athletic director, and he did, writes it. This was leaked on purpose. It was to kind of grease the move of getting Les Miles out. Well, it backfires against Joe Oliva because Les Miles ends up being kind of the martyr even the people that wanted to move on from Les Miles felt like, wait a minute, you want the guy out, go ahead and say it. Don't let him dangle. So he became a martyr. The national media said, hey, this guy won a national championship, yada, yada, yada. Now we're going towards the end of the season. And Joe Oliva has this plan that he's going to outsmart everybody. He's going to get Jimbo Fisher from Florida State. There was no plan B. He was the guy. So as Les Miles is twisting in the wind and everything is coming in, it is the week prior to the Texas A&M game. And I'm told we got Jimbo Fisher. We're working on the deal. Okay, great, I say. I kind of reach out. I know Jimbo Fisher very well. Reach with Jimmy Sexton. And I sense from that side, Jimbo's not leaving Florida State, that he's just trying to get a better deal from his president at Florida State and going to stay at Florida State. So out of loyalty to LSU, I try to tell him, look, guys tend to tell you what you want to hear. You just need to be prepared to have a plan B, because there is a high probability that this will not happen with Jimbo Fisher. Oh, no, I'm being told. He's coming. He's got it. We got it. It's done. Okay, so this is now Monday and Tuesday of Texas A&M week. Okay, Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, conversation about 6:30 in the evening. Start to have some doubt. I'm like, well, you have a plan? No, we still think we can get him. Thanksgiving Day goes. It's Friday morning after Thanksgiving, day after Thanksgiving. It's before the A&M game on Saturday. And it is, you know what, hitting the fan at LSU. Because the Friday morning was when basically Jimbo got his new deal at Florida State, which included new improvements to the facilities and whatnot. He ain't coming to LSU. Guess what? Joe Oliva has no plan B. There's nobody else. So now they're sitting there. It's Friday. The Board of Supervisors are coming in for the game on Saturday, and they got nothing. Meanwhile, Les Miles is still dangling in the wind, and you know the whole story. He's let out in the A&M game. It's a standing ovation. His final curtain call, we know the whole deal. He gets carried off the field after beating A&M. And, yes, it was not decided at halftime in some booth what they were going to do. The decision had been made that Friday. There was no other option. And the president told Joe Oliva, you need to keep Les Miles. We can't afford, with him dangling in the wind, to now conduct a search. So, two mistakes made there. If Joe Oliva would have just kept his mouth shut and not leaked it to the media, he could have just gone ahead. No one would have questioned anything. They could have quietly tried to do a deal, maybe leverage Jimbo Fisher against someone else, maybe could have got a deal done with Jimbo Fisher, and just at the end of the season announced that, hey, we're making a move on Les Miles, and then boom, within a couple of days you hire your coach, it's Jimbo Fisher or someone else. But no, they leaked it. So now everybody has to have an answer. My God, the season's over. So they're sitting there, and it's Saturday night. Well, what are we going to do? If you don't have another plan, Joe Oliva's told by his chancellor, then we're not going to sit there and buy out less and not have another plan, then begin a search. This is going to make us look like morons. Well, then there comes the ill-fated press conference of Joe Oliva saying, hey, well, I said we were going to make the decision after the season, and then it's the season's over 8 minutes ago, and now, of course, we're going to keep Les Miles. That was all part of poor management of the situation that led to it. So now we go into the offseason. there's still a pretty good idea that, hey, look, we're likely going to have to make a move on Les Miles. So they decided in the summer, and credit them for proper planning here, that if there's a problem, we're going to hire Ed Orgeron as interim head coach because he's done it before at USC, and we need to be prepared for that. Well, the Auburn game in 2016 leads to bad ending. Les is fired that Sunday, and off we go with Ed interim role. And so it takes us to the end of last season where at that point again, LSU tells me they clearly get Jimbo Fisher anytime they want it, was what I was told, that he wanted the job and whatnot. I never had that impression from Jimbo, Jimmy Sexton, and the word was given to Joe Oliva that, listen, you know, unless it's some, you know, unbelievable offer, you know, and he threw out some gaudy figures, there's, you know, not any way he'd even consider it. In essence, look, you never say never when you're an agent. You don't know. You want to elicit the best offer that you can. So if there is some sort of an offer that's going to pay him ridiculous amounts, maybe $8 million a year, something like that, make him the highest paid head coach by a long shot, sure, he'd consider that. We'll see if Florida State matches it. Probably won't. And then, you know, yeah, he'd probably consider that. But there was a clear rebuff again. No, there was no official offer from LSU. It never got to that point because there was never enough interest by Jimbo Fisher through his agent, Jimmy Sexton, that it was worth pursuing. So LSU clearly jumps on Tom Herman, the hot coach at Houston. Well, there again, instead of going in with a plan and saying, let's meet with them, let's offer it, and say, you got 24 hours to accept the deal, they go in, they negotiate with them, they talk with them, they have a pretty good feel and a pretty good sense that he might be interested. However, Tom Herman wants the Texas job. It's a Texas guy, who's a graduate assistant there. Trace Armstrong, his agent, former Florida player and NFL player, is in the agent business now. Clearly, and goes back to Texas, said, got an offer from LSU. Texas, which was really wanting to keep Charlie Strong, but then the Kansas loss and just the final straw of all of that, we're going to lose our guy. Let's jump on Tom Herman and Texas not wanting to lose a guy. Everybody became on board. Let's get him done. So basically LSU left themselves vulnerable by not getting a deal done. To some degree, there's not a whole lot they could have done there because Texas used him. Joe Oliva allowed himself to be used again. LSU should have had another plan to go and hire other people. Ed Orgeron would have waited as long as LSU wanted him to wait. No one else was interested in hiring Joe Oliva. Yes, they needed to put coordinators together, but there was time for that. Instead, Joe Oliva, ego in wanting to announce Ed Orgeron as the coach and say, we never offered anything to Jimbo Fisher. We never offered anything to Tom Herman, which was false and false. They made offers on both. They wanted to announce Ed Orgeron before Texas made their announcement. In essence, yeah, this is who we wanted. Well, all that does is show that you're stupid and you're an egomaniac because you're just wanting to beat them to the punch in the press conference. Well, you ended up being left with the short hand there. So that is kind of how it played out and how Ed Orgeron has a job. Now, the theory was after having a guy in Les Miles that would never listen to him, he got a guy in Ed Orgeron who would do whatever he'd want him to do. Go and hire coordinators. Okay, JoJo, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it, you know, as Ed would say. And so they go out and we're going to spend money on coordinators and we're just going to prop up a head coach, just kind of be a head coach, and he's going to talk and be all Cajun. And, you know, we're going to let the offensive coordinator just run the offense, the defense coordinator run the defense. Folks, there's a problem. And, again, an administrator doesn't know this because you're talking about somebody that doesn't know football. If you don't have a head coach that has a strong handle on the football team, then where does the coordinators go for assistance? And where is their accountability? Well, there is not. And that's led to the problems that they've had in the early part of the staff. Ed is not in tune or in touch with what's going on. There's not the respect by his coordinators to Ed. And it's really caused a lot of problems. It's definitely some issues in recruiting that has led to some of the personnel gaps on this team. But this team is poorly developed, poorly coached. They're not very tough. They're very undisciplined. And much like Leonard Fournette did his own thing last year, Arden Key and Darius Geis are doing their own thing. And we're going to go to the pro game. We don't care about LSU. We care about ourselves. And that's being allowed. Players coach, undisciplined is what they're getting. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out the rest of the year. There's a huge buyout for Ed Orgeron and his assistants. They're already paying Les Miles. I really believe that the best thing for LSU is to eat the $2 million or so buyout for Joe Oliva and start anew there. I think there needs to be a national search for the best athletic director they can get that can oversee this program and make a decision, and it would maybe help things and at least take this another year where the buyout for Ed is less and then they move forward there. We'll see how it plays out. But that is a long-winded, I know, overview of the rise and fall of LSU football from the inside. Hope that gives you a better understanding of how things played out. We appreciate you joining us on this edition of the Landry Football Podcast. We'll get more into the film breakdowns of the games this past weekend and look ahead to the games of this upcoming weekend here on Thursday. We appreciate you joining us. Talk to you again next time.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is the Crush Report with Jeff Crushell.
Is it possible that your vision could determine how good you are at something? We spoke with Dr. Daniel Levy.
Yeah, it's really a pedigree. You know, each different sport has a different requirement for the visual package, if you will. With the Olympic team, we found that the boxers, for example, don't have great visual acuity, sharpness, but they don't need it because the target is close, but they have pretty good depth perception. Whereas the archers had wonderful sharpness of vision, but they had terrible depth perception. It all makes sense because the archery target is flat and there's no 3D of the target, and they usually are monocular, looking at one eye at the sight and the other eye at the target in archery, and so they're not using both eyes together. So you wouldn't expect good depth perception, but they better see sharply because the target is far away and the target is very small. Whereas the boxers need to have 3D vision because they're having to judge how far their opponent is and how close the oncoming punch is and so forth. The fencers, excellent, excellent depth perception, probably the best, I think, overall. So you can almost take a young kid who's athletic, look at their visual abilities, and maybe put a little bit extra time in to make sure they're able to work even better in the sports that they match to, as opposed to sports they just may enjoy, but probably don't have a chance to become elite at.
Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.